Why does Rice play Texas? We choose to go to the moon. We choose to go to the moon. We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things. Not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
I was always a dreamer. I always saw a life beyond the life that I had as a child.
It was like a big flashing light. This is what you're supposed to do.
Everybody poo-pooed the idea. Network said it couldn't be done.
You're in that zone, and it's that out-of-body experience where it just, everything clicks.
Sometimes you have those dark moments. I was so depressed when I got fired.
I was so mad.
People don't need to be afraid to fail. And again, that's where you learn. You shouldn't be afraid of adversity. You know, that is the thing that makes you strong.
This is Jerry Levias.
This is Jody Markell.
This is Chi Young.
This is Dick Vitale, and you're listening to American Achievers.
Welcome to American Achievers, the podcast that celebrates ambition, commitment to excellence, risk-taking, and tenacity on the road to success. I'm Keith Dunovant. Some of my guests are world-famous. Some are rather obscure. Our weekly lineup includes entrepreneurs, athletes, military heroes, civic leaders, artists, and media figures. What they all have in common is a sense of undeniable purpose and an intriguing story that reflects the power of the American dream. The time seems increasingly distant, and in a way it seems like yesterday. In that fast-fading golden age, the big city newspaper was many different things to a large and diverse readership. The outsized role of the sports columnist in this equation was widely acknowledged. In a time before social media warped our perception of reality, before the 24-hour news cycle caused us to value speed over perspective, the artful sports columnist, meticulously laboring over every line, gave us a front-row seat to the big events and major figures of the day, painting vivid pictures and offering fearless opinions. Sometimes he wrote things that made you mad. Other times he touched a nerve and made you think. You saw his little picture staring out at you 3 or 4 times a week, and you felt like you knew him. Jim Murray at the Los Angeles Times, Red Smith at the New York Times, Skip Bayless at the Dallas Times-Herald, Furman Bisher at the Atlanta Journal. These gentlemen and others were poets of a time and place that no longer exists, and very few could match the quiet eloquence of Dave Kindred. In a career that took him from small-town Illinois to coveted positions in Louisville, Washington, Atlanta, and New York, Kindred methodically turned his boyhood dream into reality. He didn't want to be famous. He didn't want to cozy up to the sports stars he was covering. He just wanted to be a magician with words. And he was. Kindred's unvarnished prose, straight from the heartland, full of candor and wit, made him one of the greatest sports writers of all time. Dave, great to have you with us today. Hope you are doing well.
I'm doing very well. It's a beautiful day here in central Illinois, 65 degrees. The sun is shining, and all is well.
Well, it's about time for you to get out and play some golf then, right?
Well, I hope to, but, you know, I wake up every morning with a different part of my body aching. And lately, it's been both shoulders. So I'm not sure that I played golf often in Washington, D.C. with one of my heroes in the sports writing business, Shirley Povich. And it was always my ambition to become 86 years old, as Shirley was the last time I played with him. And he hit a very bad shot and pronounced, "I think I've lost some clubhead speed." So that's my ambition, is to be 86 years old worrying about my clubhead speed.
Well, my goal is to be 86 and to be vertical, so that would be fine.
I'm nearer that than you.
Tell us about your earliest memory.
My earliest memory had to have occurred before I was 4 years old, because when I was 4 years old, we lived in a little house down one corner from the house I grew up in. And in that little house, I remember getting for Christmas a toy truck with rubber tires on it, little bitty truck with rubber tires, and one of the tires came off. And I figured out how to get it back on. And my father, a carpenter, said, "You must be going to be a mechanic." Well, he couldn't have been more wrong, but that's the first memory. That literally is the first thing I remember in my life.
So how did growing up in Illinois, how did that shape you?
I think it shaped me well. It shaped me in a way that people have said Dave's values are the values of a person who left Atlanta, Illinois, when he was 20 years old and never psychically left. His body went other places, but he was still, his life values, the things that he thought was important, all those things are still important to him. And while I left Illinois when I was 24 years old, and came back 45 years later, it was inevitable that we would come back and live here. I met my wife as a junior in high school. We were married 59 years, and we wound up coming back here when we were 70 years old. So whatever influence Midwestern values had on me, I lived with those, and they shaped the way that I thought and probably shaped the way that I wrote about everything.
Well, your mother bought you a special present that was going to have an important impact on your life. What was it?
I've written about that before. I said that my father gave me a love of baseball, and my mother gave me a typewriter. When I was 15 years old, she bought a Royal portable typewriter at an auction. And I remember sitting at the kitchen table with that typewriter. I was already writing by then for the just for myself, really, at home with the pen and paper. And she bought me this typewriter. And I sat at the kitchen table, loving the typewriter, put a piece of paper in, but I sat there until I would type something that I would remember forever. I wanted to remember forever the first words I typed. Now, I don't know why a kid, I was 15 years old, why a kid would think that way, unless he knew somewhere in his mind that he was going to be typing forever. But I think it was probably a decision that had been made for me. And so I sat there until I figured out that I would type one name, Stanley Frank Musial. Musial then was still in his prime with the St. Louis Cardinals. I was a Cardinals fan, had grown up listening to Harry Carey on radio every night. And so first words I typed, Stanley Frank Musial.
And what was the first sentence?
I don't know that. I don't know that.
Dave!
I'm sure that it had several typing mistakes. It turned out that I needed to learn to type. That was a hunt and peck system. But I turned out to be the only boy in typing class in high school. Some people have suggested that I did that for purposes other than learning to type, but not really. I really wanted to be able to type. And so I would watch University of Illinois games on television and write a little story for myself. I would listen to the Cardinals at night, write a little story for myself. So I don't remember those stories, and I do wish I had some of them.
Well,
but I was, from the time I was 15, I'm one of the lucky people, Keith, and that from the time I was 15, I knew what I wanted to do. I knew what I wanted to be, and I was lucky enough to be able to make that happen. I wanted to be a sports writer, and so here it is a long time later, and I'm still writing sports stories.
Which we're going to get to here eventually. When did Red Smith enter your life as an icon?
I was a subscriber to the Daily Pantograph, Bloomington, Illinois Daily Pantograph. And I lived in the summers in order to play Little League Baseball at my grandmother's house in Lincoln, Illinois. Every Sunday morning, I would go to the train station to pick up the Chicago newspapers. I would read Red Smith in the Chicago newspapers, and eventually his column appeared in the Daily Pantograph also. So I first read him probably when I was, 13, 14, 15 in that time, a time when I really was able to read and understand that this was something special. And so from the first time I read Red Smith, I love the sound of the words. I love the places that he went. I love the way that he described action. I love the language. He seemed to be having fun. And I thought, that's who I want to be. I'd love to be Red Smith someday.
Your first byline in a newspaper, when was that, and how did that make you feel?
February 19th, 1959. I have the newspaper. I could take three steps from this table and get the newspaper. I have the literal newspaper from that day. The Atlanta Argus Lens. It was our local weekly, and I wrote about the Atlanta Red Wings. The Atlanta Red Wings being the high school basketball team. We were 29-0 that year before losing. I started to say I was a point guard, but the term point guard hadn't been invented back then. Basketball had barely been invented back then.
When you first began to realize that you were pretty good at this, how did that affect you, the way you saw yourself?
It didn't. You know, I never really had that thought to begin with. My thought every day was to make every day's column or whatever I was working on the best thing that I could make it. Some days the material is there and you can really make it good. Some days the material is not there. It took me a long time to learn that part of it, Keith. It took me a long time to learn that you can't always make something out of nothing. So it made it easier, actually. But I just wanted to be the best that I could be every day. That's all I ever cared about. I read all the time as a kid. I read all the time as a professional writer. I read all the time and I wrote all the time. And I just wanted to make every one of them better than the last one. I suppose when I went to Louisville, the first job that I had. Well, we can do that later. But I went to Louisville as a copy editor and told the guy, that the boss, that I wanted to write. He said, well, if you find a story, write it. Back in those days, newspapers wanted everything they could get in the newspaper because they were selling ads. I didn't even know newspapers sold ads until I was about 30 years old. I thought the ads just got in the way of the stories. But I started writing just kind of freelancing at the newspaper I was working for, and they kept publishing them. So I figured, okay, that's good. And I became a columnist then 3 years later.
Well, but let's talk about that era of newspapering. Explain to the uninitiated what a copy editor was at that point. And this is obviously a decade plus before the computer age, and it was a very different age in newspapers.
My first, you know, I went to Illinois Wesleyan University on a journalism scholarship provided by the Pantograph. So I worked at the Pantograph, 4 years while I was in school and 2 years after I got out. So I was at the Pantograph for 6 years. The Pantograph work that I did was the hardest work I ever did. because I worked the desk there. Working the desk means that you're in charge of what goes into the newspaper. You're reading every piece of copy that somebody's producing. You're editing it. You're writing headlines. You're leaving the office to go take pictures at a local basketball game. You're developing them yourself. You're printing them. You're telling the people in the back, you're telling the composing room where to put the type. You're literally producing a sports section by yourself. So I did that for 6 years. By the time I got to Louisville, 2 years later, because I wanted to be a writer, I wasn't going to be an editor of any kind. The only job they had was as a copy editor. You'd be one of four or five guys sitting around, and they were all guys at that time, sitting around a desk. People would be bringing you copy. They would be bringing typewritten copy on paper. You would paste those pieces of paper together. You would edit them. You would cross out words, whatever. You would literally, you know, literally pen and ink editing. And there's where I learned a valuable lesson too. I had a, you know, because you'd give the copy paper to a guy punching tape that would then, the tape would be run through a linotype machine. The linotype machine would spit out metal, cold, hot type, pieces of hot type. Those pieces of hot type would be collected into a story that would be put on a iron form called a chase. It's where he also learned union rules. The newspaper people, the reporters, etc., were not allowed to touch that type. Anytime you touched that type, the printer, a member of the union, would whack you across your knuckles with a pica stick. Pica being a term of measurement. So you quickly learn that you can't touch the type. But it was like those 6 years got me ready for everything that happened for the next 50 years. It was like the greatest graduate master's program in what journalism is, what producing a newspaper is, that anybody could imagine. So it was, a copy editor would read somebody's literal copy. They'd take it out of the typewriter, hand it to you. You'd edit it, you'd cross out words, you'd write in words, and then somebody would take it from you and set it into type.
You were a young reporter in Louisville when you got an assignment concerning Cassius Clay one day, and you didn't realize this was going to become a career-long relationship. What happened that day?
Had no idea of that. No idea, Keith. That was in this interim period when I went to the Courier-Journal as a copy editor, wanting to write, being told anytime you get a story, you can write it. So one day, and I'm also serving as Mr. Mom, because my wife was a registered nurse. We had a 3-year-old son. She would go to work at 6 a.m. I would go to work, not work, but I would go to the newspaper at 7 or 8 and take our son with me. You know, it was my way of babysitting while trying to find a story to write. And one day I'm in there. I've written one story at this point. Texas Western was a good basketball team that year. I wrote a story. I called El Paso, Texas, and did a story on my own about Texas Western. So I'd written one story. I'm in the office one day, and a boss, everybody was my boss, comes to me and says, "Clay's in town, go find him." Well, at that time, his name had already been changed. He'd already changed his name to Muhammad Ali, but the Louisville paper style was to refer to him as Cassius Clay, AKA Muhammad Ali. So Clay's in town, go find him. Well, okay, I knew who Clay was, but I didn't know, how am I supposed to go find him? I was had been in Louisville about 2 months. I didn't know where anything was. So the boss, by way of instruction, says, "Just go ask Cash." Well, okay, who's Cash? Cash being Cassius Clay Sr., who operated an art gallery about two blocks from the newspaper. So I walked down to Cash's place and asked him where his son is. I called him the champ. Where is the champ? I don't know. Probably down there hanging out. So down there, where is that? So I'm full of these questions of a guy lost in time. Turns out that it was in the west end of Louisville, where most of the African-American population was. So I went there near their home house, their home where Clay had grown up, on Grand Avenue, and just rolled down the window, had my son with me in the car, just rolled down the window and asked the first person I saw, anybody seen Cassius? Well, everybody had seen Cassius, because Cassius was visiting all his neighborhood haunts. So I find him, and he rides around with me in the car all day, taking me to places that he wanted me to see. This is a world heavyweight champion. At that time, probably not quite the most famous man in the world, but he was on his way to becoming that. And I'm driving around Louisville. One of the things we did was we went and saw, he says, you got to see this telephone pole. I said, okay, what telephone pole? Joe Louis leaned against this telephone pole. I said, okay. So we went there and I saw the telephone pole that Joe Louis leaned against. We rode around all day. At one point, we stopped someplace where there was a giant scales. I don't remember where it was. I just remember the scene. Clay wanted to weigh himself. Ali wanted to weigh himself. So he held my son, Jeff, in his arms to be weighed on this scale. It may have been in the Courier Journal press room. And so I just thought that he was a nice guy. I thought he was just a sweetheart. You know, I wasn't smart enough, or I was too intimidated to ask him the month before he had said, he had indicated he was not going to join the Army. He had said a month before, I ain't got no quarrel with them Viet Cong. Well, I never asked him about that. Afraid to ask him about it, you know, or just forgot to ask him. I'm not sure. I was just kind of in over my head. And I wrote a routine kind of story about he was in town to promote a fight to benefit a children's hospital. So that's what I wrote that day. But I didn't, all the stuff I've just told you, I never wrote at that time. If I'm doing a memoir now, and if I ever get to it in a way that makes sense, I'll tell those stories in that book. But that was my first day. That was October 26th, 1966. The last time I saw Ali was in September, I think, of 2003, when I went to Berrien Springs and saw him at his home in Berrien Springs, Michigan. So what's that, 34, 37 years that I wrote about, and that wasn't the last time I wrote about him. Yeah, I started writing about him in 66 and have written about him all probably literally every year since. Written more about him than I have anything in my life. And had no idea that would happen because, again, I was just a kid. I was 24, he was 25. I was a kid starting out in the business with no idea that I would wind up going to 17 of his fights, 10 of his championship fights. I would go to one of the great events in American sports history, really, the first Ali Frazier fight. Had no idea of any of that. It just kind of developed. I was, I think maybe the old guys in there were turned off by Ali, and I was turned on by Ali. I think it was a generational thing at that point. I know Red Smith was one of the old timers who had nothing to do with Ali. Dick Young, none of them, Jimmy Cannon, none of those great sports writers a generation ahead of me wanted anything to do with Ali. They thought that he was, they'd grown up with Joe Louis and Jack Dempsey. They'd grown up with silent heroes. And Ali, of course, was anything but a silent hero.
Looking back on his life now, Dave, you, I think my research says that you interviewed him about 300 times. You had obviously a very close relationship with him. He trusted you. I think that's fair to say. What do you make of his coming on the scene at that point in the 60s, reflecting the culture, a very different sort of hero?
I was a year younger than him, and I'm a year out of Central Illinois. You know, I'm a year out of covering Saybrook Aerosmith basketball, you know, and suddenly I'm with this guy who very quickly, you know, 67, 68, becomes literally the most famous man in the world. And I had no real grasp of what was happening. You know, I had no real grasp of that this was history being made in front of me. You know, I was thrown into a situation where I just grew with it. And I'm not sure, but my take on Ali from the start was that he was this sweetheart guy. He was this sweetheart kid from Louisville who carried my son around. You know, he was not an angry guy. I thought that he was, the book I did on him, I did a dual biography of Ali and Cosell, Howard Cosell. The book I did on him, I said that one of the kind of myths about Ali was that he was a leader. He was never a leader. He was a follower. And in his early years, he was a follower of the Nation of Islam sect and its leader, Elijah Muhammad. And he bought into that entirely. And I don't think, and said some of the most racially offensive things that anybody could ever have said. But when Elijah Muhammad died in 1974, Ali presented a public face that was the Ali that I had known. He was no longer a ranting racist. He was no longer a religious bigot. You know, he was a sweetheart. And that's the Ali that people came to know. Yes, he was on the right side of history in the whole Vietnam thing. And yes, he probably never really thought about what he was doing. He was just doing what that he thought was right. Some of it was what Elijah Muhammad told him to do, and he followed instructions from him. But in any case, he inspired a lot of people in that time to at least examine their beliefs, examine why they thought what they did. Whether he ever examined his own is questionable, but I know he caused millions of people to examine their thoughts and beliefs. And in the end, or not even in the end, you know, through the 70s and 80s, he became the guy that I thought that I had known. And that's the guy that I wanted to write a book about. And that's why I did that book. You know, and in that book, I try to explain all of that.
It's a terrific book, The Sound and the Fury, a terrific book about Ali and Cosell. And you describe a scene, one of my favorite scenes in that book, is when you talk about being in bed with Ali, which had all sorts of symbolism attached to it. Tell me about that moment.
Well, it was another one of those moments that I didn't know what to do or how to deal with it. It was in Las Vegas. I don't remember the details of it. But it was in Las Vegas for some fight. It was not a big fight, just another one of his championship fights against somebody that's long been forgotten. I go to his hotel room. He was always the most accessible of athletes, the most accessible celebrity of all time. He wanted people around him at all times. I go to his suite in Las Vegas. There's a middle room full of people. There are two bedrooms, one to the left, one to the right. I go there. I see him in bed in the right-hand bedroom. And he sees me. He waves to me. He says, Louisville. He called me Louisville. I don't know if he ever knew my name, but he knew I was his hometown guy. Louisville, come in here. So I go in. I want to write a column about his entourage. And I'm asking him questions. he can't hear me. I can't hear him because there are too many people everywhere. There must have been 100 people in that center place, and even around his bedroom. And so he lifts up the corner of the sheet and says, "Get in." So I don't know what you would do, Keith, if the heavyweight champion of the world says, "Get in bed with me." But I did, because I wanted to, I was working, I was still trying to do a column. And so we're in bed, and one of us, as I've said, telling this story, one of us had on clothes. He takes my notebook, and we pull his sheets up like we're a couple of little kids hiding from our parents. And he takes my notebook and starts writing down the names of the people in his entourage and how much he's paying them each week. So I thank him. I take that, ask a couple of questions about whatever fight it was, and I leave, or I start to leave, and I had to stop and go back and get my notebook because he had kept it. But things like that, you know, it sounds unusual, and I didn't write about it at the time because it sounded so unusual. But things like that were happening around Ali all the time, things that you couldn't imagine happening. I mean, I told a guy the other day that you can make a movie out of every day of Ali's life in those, say, from 64 to 80. Every day of his life was a movie. And I didn't write that day. I used it in the book, as you said, by way of showing how, you know, literally close I was with him. But every day was something. Every day was something with Ali. You know, he wanted things to happen. He made things happen. And it was always fun. It was almost, I was never uncomfortable around him. I was uncomfortable around some of, what do they call them? Some of the Nation of Islam guys who always looked like linebackers recruited to look mean. I was nervous around them. But I was never uncomfortable around Ali. It was always fun.
Tell me about the thriller in Manila.
Well, that's one of the great regrets of my career. Louisville Courier Journal basically created the columnist that I am because they let me do almost everything. And I say almost everything because they would not send me to Manila. They would not send me to Zaire. The problem with both of those fights being that it cost too much. Well, it was going to cost $600 to go on a charter from Louisville to New York to Zaire. And they wouldn't pay the $600. I was at that time 32 years old. If I had been 42 years old, and told the newspaper's not going to spend $600 to send me to what was going to be one of the great fights of all time, I'd have thrown a typewriter through a window, or I'd have thrown the sports editor through a window or something. But then I was still like 3 or 4 years into the column writing business, and I didn't make an issue out of it. I just said, okay. But the two regrets of my career is I was not able to go to Zaire or Manila, but I can certainly talk about Manila. I can talk about both of those things. I've seen both fights on film, you know, dozens of times, and have read about them and have written about them. The fight in Manila was, I think Ali himself said, was the closest thing to death, you know, and both fighters in that could have died that night. It was one of the great sports events ever. And the fight in Zaire with Foreman, 74, when he reclaimed the championship and should have retired, when he reclaimed the championship then, I thought all the time that Ali was going to win that fight because he was just he was so quick, such a better thinker in the ring than Foreman. Frazier, though, was scary. Frazier was not afraid of Ali. Frazier could not be put off by Ali. Still, you know, the greatest sports event that I ever attended or ever that ever certainly that I ever attended was the first Frazier Ali fight in Madison Square Garden in 71. Ali had been out for 4 years. They had taken his license away from him to fight. So he had not fought in 4 years. By the time he got to Frazier, he had been 4 years out with two fights in between. He fought Jerry Quarry in Atlanta in October. He fought Oscar Bonavina a month later. Oscar Bonavina was a bull, a fighter from Argentina. Ali knocked him out in the 15th round. Could have gone either way. And then 2 months later, he fights Frazier, who had done nothing but just mow down everybody in front of him for the last 3 years. So Frazier was in much the better athletic position in that fight. Ali was still enough of Ali that it was a great contest. Although I remember vividly, my press row seat was literally at ringside across from Ali's corner. And Ali, early in the fight, was clowning around. He was giving away rounds, really. Leaning against the ropes, leaning back. He looked down. He looked right at me. I don't know if he was looking at me because he knew me or if he just happened to be locking eyes on whoever happened to be in that seat. But he looked down at me and said, "No contest. No contest." Meanwhile, Frazier is just, beating him around the shoulders, beating him around the hips, beating him. It must have hit him 20 times while Ali is saying it's no contest. Well, it was a contest. It was a contest from beginning to end. Ali winds up losing a unanimous decision. Two judges had it relatively close. If Ali hadn't given away rounds early, he might have won the fight on a decision. But it was one of the, 20,000 people at Madison Square Garden in New York. Everybody who was anybody was there. It was the only time in my life, that when it was over, I couldn't write anything. Luckily, I was writing for the Louisville Times, the afternoon newspaper then. So I had all night to try to figure out what to say.
You had writer's block after that?
One of the things I learned. Not writer's block. I just didn't know what to say. I was so into Ali, both as a local story and just as a guy that I had connected with. And it was the third fight I had ever seen in my entire life. So it was overwhelming sensory experience, both the fight and the surroundings. And I also learned that if you have any emotional connection to a fight, an emotional connection will make you favor one fighter over another. If you have any kind of emotional connection, you cannot see the other guy in the fight. So I saw Ali only for like the first 6, 7, 8 rounds. But Frazier, you could not see him because he was always in, as you would say today, he was always in Ali's grill. He had his forehead up against Ali's chin all the time. He never stopped coming forward. It was the most amazing athletic feat. I mean, I don't know if people really understand how hard it is to be a boxer. I mean, just walk around your room throwing punches for 3 minutes. See how your arms feel. Then try doing that for 45 minutes against Muhammad Ali. Frazier never stopped. He was as great as you could be that night. So anytime I have to list, the great events that I've seen, that's always number one because the demand is so much of both of them.
Okay, well, you brought it up, so I have to ask now, what are some of the other great events?
Secretariat went into Belmont by 31 lengths. First Triple Crown winner in, at that time, 28 years. Citation had won in 1945. had won the Triple Crown. Secretariat wins the Belmont, which is the hardest of all thoroughbred races, mile and a half. The Kentucky Derby is a mile and a quarter, a mile and a half. Secretariat ran every quarter of that mile and a half faster than the previous quarter. Think of that. He ran the last quarter of a mile and a half race faster than he ran the first quarter. Won by 31 lengths. I'm standing next to Joe Falls, who at that time was the Detroit Free Press columnist. Falls nudges me and says, "Citation my ass." Yes, that was, you know, three words. It's all you needed for that story. That was a great event. You know, another great event that nobody knows about except me, because I cared about Daytona 500, was 1976, I think, maybe five, when Richard Petty and David Pearson, you know, a generational rivalry, crashed coming out of the fourth turn. Petty was trying to pass him low, which was impossible because the laws of physics at 180 miles an hour make your car move up on the track. So it moved up on the track, collided with Pearson, and they both went spinning down the track. And Pearson somehow had enough instinct, I guess, to push in the clutch on his car and keep it running. So he crossed the finish line at about 1 mile an hour to win that 500. It was one of the great finishes I've ever seen. But can I tell you one more?
Absolutely.
Well, and this is not, nobody remembers this one either, but it was 1972 Nebraska-Oklahoma football game. And I remember it because there was a famous publicist, Beano Cook, later worked for ESPN as an unlikely sports announcer. Beano was the sports information director at Pitt at the time. I covered the Oklahoma-Nebraska game. Nebraska won 35-32 and wrote a lead saying, you know, they can quit playing football now. They've played the perfect game. It was a great game. Beano Cook became kind of, I didn't know him at the time, but I kept hearing from people around the country that Beano was telling people it was the greatest lead on any college football game ever. So I always thank Beano for that. Because it got me a little notice around the country.
You're listening to American Achievers. Stay tuned for more conversation.
So eventually, here a few years later, you move on into the Washington Post, and you become a peer and a friend of Red Smith.
Well, I wouldn't say I was a peer. Not a peer, but I did get to know him, you know, spent a lot of time with him, you know, had a lot of dinners with him. But he was, again, I mean, he was just such a down-to-earth guy to have such great talent that I liked to hang around him, just hoping that some of it would rub off on me. You know, because he was, however he was doing it, was the way that I wanted to do it. And so I knew him, you know, always happy, you know, because by the time I knew him, he was old and frail, becoming frail. And I would always be among those people offering to carry his typewriter, just so you could someday tell a guy on a podcast, "Hey, I carried Red Smith's typewriter." Yeah, so I did. You know, Yankee Stadium one time, you know, going down to the press room to eat. "I'll carry it, Red." So I did. Yeah, and he was just a lovely sweetheart. And I basically got to know, you know, again, you know, the gift of geography, really. You know, yes, there's Muhammad Ali. You know, I wind up working in a town that produced Muhammad Ali. But probably more important in my career development, the way my career went, was the Kentucky Derby. Because the first Saturday in May every year, at that time, every famous sports writer in America came to Louisville for the Kentucky Derby. So it was like, I always thought of it as, yeah, I got to meet them all. Red, Jimmy Cannon, all of them. You know, everybody who was anybody in the sports writing business would be in Louisville for the first week in May. And met Shirley Povich, and who was then still writing daily for the Washington Post. And Povich pulled me aside one day and just complimented me on the stuff I was doing that week. And later I got a call from the Post. They wanted to hire me. As I'd be the Navy beat guy, Naval Academy beat guy, and I'd be number two on the Redskins. At that time, the Washington Post was not the Washington Post of Watergate. That hadn't happened yet. So it wasn't an instant, oh yeah, I'd love that. It was more like, well, you don't have Adolf Rupp, you know, coaching Navy basketball, and the Redskins are nothing. So who cares about them? Although the Redskins that year hired Vince Lombardi. So I missed by a year of being number two covering Lombardi. But I wasn't, and I also wasn't ready. I wanted to be a columnist, you know, and I had a better chance of becoming a columnist in Louisville than I did going to the Washington Post. So I had turned them down then, but they came back later.
So at that point, you really are taking a step up into, you know, you have one of the great columnist jobs in the country. You are a peer of Red Smith. I'm going to fight you on this, okay?
Okay.
So you have to feel at that point, I know you've got your head down, you're trying to do your job, but you have to have the feeling of the kid who got the typewriter as the present from the mother, used to, you know, take the train, go to the train station to buy the paper so he could read Red Smith. You're now a friend of Red Smith. I mean, come on. This is the American dream at work here, right?
If you say so, because I just never thought of it that way. I mean, you know, I wanted to be like all kids. I wanted to be a Major League Baseball player. When it became obvious through a certain lack of physical skills that I was never going to be a Major League Baseball player, I wanted to be a Major League Baseball writer. And then I met a Major League Baseball writer, and I didn't want to be that guy. But I did want to be a big league writer. You know, and so literally the only job I ever wanted was the job that I wind up having. You know, I wanted to be a sports columnist. It's what I wanted to do. And when I did it, you know, another little anecdote here. I know some of this stuff, Keith, because I'm trying to write some of this now. So I'm revisiting my life while I still can. And my first week at the Washington Post, Don Graham, who was then the publisher of the Post, he was the grandson of the original founder of the modern Washington Post. Don Graham comes to the sports department to welcome me. Welcome to the Post. I said, thank you. And he says, where are you living? I said, well, we bought a house down by Mount Vernon, down to Mount Vernon Parkway. You know, if George Washington was still alive, I would have been his neighbor. We bought a house in Mount Vernon, down by Mount Vernon. And Don kind of looks at me quizzically and says, you bought a house? I said, yeah, I didn't go into it more than that, but we had owned a house, we had bought a house and built a house in Louisville. So why not buy a house in Washington, D.C.? Well, maybe because the guy who had preceded me in succeeding Shirley Povich was a guy who lasted maybe 8 months in the job. So apparently I should have been renting until it was obvious that I could do the job. So I think what that showed me, or what it occurs to me now, is I was confident and I was naive. You know, if I'd really been a logical thinker, okay, well, let's see if this works out. Let's see if I really can do this. Let's see if we like this. Let's see if they like me. And so they did. And I just kept, I kept my head down. I mean, I have regrets about it. I have some regrets about it. And I only stayed there 7 years. And some of that grew out of these regrets that the job took over my life. I wanted the job to take over my life. And it did. My wife came to hate the sound of the phone ringing because it was always the sports editor telling me, by the way, when you go to Los Angeles this week, stop by Miami Beach. Well, if you got a map out, those aren't really on the same path. But it was like that. I was going somewhere all the time, and my wife didn't like that. And eventually I didn't like it either. And we had money problems. I had money problems. I had turned down a job at the Chicago Sun-Times for $15,000 a year more than the job I took at the Washington Post because I didn't want to work at the Chicago Sun-Times. And I did want to work at the Post. By then, the Post was the Watergate era Post. It was everybody's idea of what a newspaper was. So it was a great honor to be invited up for an interview, let alone to actually be hired. But I took the job at a cut rate. And a year and a half later, I was still working at that cut rate. So the money didn't go well there. And I was always disturbed by that. But the job was the job of anybody's dream. I did everything that I wanted to do. I went everywhere I wanted to go. And it shaped my life forever. I mean, I left the Post in 1984. And for the next 20 years, I'd say, everybody thought I still worked at the Post because the Post had such a brand. And I apparently had made such an impression or brand of my own that people still connected me with the Washington Post.
You're talking about a job that really does not exist anymore of the big city sports columnist. You had carte blanche to go cover anything you wanted to cover. What was the best part of that job as a big city sports columnist in Washington and eventually in Atlanta and New York?
Well, I think you've just described the best part of it. As I said a second ago, I would never have been a lifetime journalist except as a sports columnist. I did local, I did city side columns, I did news side columns. I might have been able to do that because I really enjoyed doing stuff outside of sports. I never thought of myself, strangely enough, as a sports writer. I always thought of myself as a writer whose subject often was sports. I could do other stuff, and I did other stuff. I did a city side column in Atlanta. I did a city side column in Louisville, in addition to the sports columns, because I mostly human interest stuff, telling stories, going places. But the big city sports column began dying maybe 20 years ago. The New York Times hastened its death by creating kind of niche sports columnists. There'd be a columnist about pro basketball. There'd be a columnist about Major League Baseball. You no longer have the generalist columnist. And that's what I was. I was the best. Again, my job was the best possible job, is that I could write about any sports event, anywhere, any way I wanted to write about it. And that doesn't happen to anybody. People are put into niches, put into boxes. And I think, why wouldn't I think this? I think it's wrong.
In those days, you had Jim Murray and Scott Osler and Mike Downey in Los Angeles. You had you in Washington. You had, in the early part of that time, you had Red Smith in New York and so forth. What did you want the reader? How did you want to affect the reader on a daily basis? What did you want to make him think and feel?
Well, I wanted to do that. I wanted to make them think, and I wanted to make them feel. I wanted to educate in the sense of telling people what happened. I wanted to inform, you know, with the reporting. I think the reporting was always the heart of the column. It was never just off the top of your head what you, you know, an opinion. You reporting, and I wanted to have fun with it. I wanted people to, I mean, Red Smith, I always go back to Red because he said wise things, and he said them in simple ways. He said that people go to games to have fun. They pick up the paper the next day to have that fun again. And that was the way that I approached it. If people went to a Redskins game, 55,000 people there, I wanted them to read the paper the next day and understand what fun it was and why it was that much fun. You know, I wanted to have a sense of humor about it. I wanted to be human about it. One of the best columns that I wrote at the Washington Post was a day that John Riggins, they won the NFC championship going to a Super Bowl. Riggins, again, had a 150-yard game, great fullback, Hall of Fame fullback, running behind an offensive line called the Hogs. Riggins was 240 pounds, 6'4", 240, something like that. And he refused to talk to the press. That whole year, he wouldn't talk to us. So now he's got one of the great games of his career. He stands at midfield at one point. The RFK, Robert F. Kennedy Stadium crowd is going crazy because they've won and he's the hero. And he bows at midfield. He bows as if he's a conductor of a great orchestra, bowing to the crowd. And so I wrote about that without ever talking to him. Needed no quotes, just told the story in a way that everyone there who saw him do it would have a feeling for why he did it and what it meant. And to me, that was, you know, telling people what, not so much the X's and O's, or almost never the X's and O's. I was not an X's and O's guy. And I don't think most readers are X's and O's guys, you know, but I was a human guy. I wanted to tell a story and share it with people. I wanted to take people to the game, take people to the event, take people to the emotion of the event and put them there. Red always said, be there. You know, he meant be there physically. I wanted people to be there psychically. I wanted people to feel what I felt. And if they didn't feel that, you know, okay, but that was, I saw that as my job, is to make people feel what I was feeling.
In that regard, did the ubiquity of television, sports, did that ruin the big city columnist?
No, I think it helped. I think it made every event a public event. It made, you know, when Shirley Povich started, maybe even when Red Smith started, television was not ubiquitous. Television hadn't even been born. They felt compelled to tell almost a play-by-play of the events that they saw, whether it was a fight or a football game. But now you could go beyond that. Now you had to assume, when I'm talking now about the 60s, 70s, 80s, you had to assume that people knew what happened. They may not know why it happened. They may not know what it meant that it happened. They may not know what they should have felt when it happened. And that's what I saw my job. I think television introduced sports, introduced it all to a huge audience. And the bigger the audience, the better it was, for me at least, to have a feeling that you're not writing into a void, but you're writing to people. I always felt that I was having a conversation with people. I wanted to tell them what I saw happen and what I think of what I saw happen.
You did a book with Joe Theismann, and I know this was after you moved to Atlanta, but I would be remiss if I didn't ask you about that moment that is seared in the memory of anybody who watched it on Monday Night Football.
I saw it once on film. I didn't see it live. I wasn't there. And I've never watched it again. Every time It's been on, you know, hundreds of times by now, but I've never watched it again. But Joe, a week later, I'd known him, of course, in Washington, and had proposed writing a book with him at some point. And he called me after Lawrence Taylor broke his leg in two. Joe called me. He was still in the hospital. I was in Atlanta. He said, "Dave, that book you want to write, I've got lots of time to do it now." So we did it. You know, it was not a pleasurable experience for me. I've never done another As Told To book, but it was fun with Joe. I mean, it was a quote machine. You couldn't shut him up. You know, if he came off the practice field and you didn't want to ask him a question, he often did this. He would pick up your tape recorder and start interviewing himself for you. So no problem getting him to talk for a book. And I enjoyed the process. I mean, I enjoyed doing it with him, but I didn't particularly enjoy that process. I told somebody once, you know, this is, and I hope Theismann never hears this, but I told somebody once, doing that book that way with Joe Theismann was like studying to be an architect and building a doghouse, because it was just too simple.
What's the one interview all your years that surprised you the most?
Oh boy. Well, actually, you know, I go back to Ali a lot because so many things with Ali, but 1974, after Elijah Muhammad died, a friend of mine, former sports information director at the University of Louisville, Gary Toole, was a big fight fan. Toole and I went to Ali's hotel room in Louisville just to see him. He was in town for something. Went to see him. And those bodyguards I mentioned before, Nation of Islam, they were called the Fruit of Islam, were in the room. They were kind of overseeing what Ali was saying. And Ali shooed them from the room. "Go away. These are my Louisville guys." And without prompting, Ali brought up the Malcolm X assassination. Malcolm X, that had happened in 67, I think, maybe.
65, I think.
Ali was then... 65. Ali was the champion anyway. Ali was the champion, and Malcolm X had been a mentor of him until Elijah Muhammad ordered Ali to divorce Malcolm X, because Malcolm X had moved another direction in the whole Nation of Islam movement. He no longer accepted the fact of white people as blue-eyed devils. He had gone to Mecca. He had found a different way to promote his spiritual beliefs. And for that, he was assassinated. Ali told Toole and I that he stayed with Elijah Muhammad. Elijah Muhammad is dead now when Ali is saying this. He said, "I stayed with Elijah because they would have done to me what they did to Malcolm." So that's kind of what I thought at the time, kind of, and it may be that Ali told us that because he figured we wanted to hear that. I was never sure with Ali if he believed what he was saying or if he was shaping what he was saying. Never was sure. I didn't write it at the time. I wrote it in the book that I did, and I hope that I don't remember what the context was in the book, but to me it was a revelation that I had never expected to hear from Ali.
How did it affect you as a human being to watch Ali, to see Ali get old?
Well, the worst of it was the fight with Larry Holmes. Should never have taken that fight. Holmes was a great fighter, truly great fighter. He was Ali's size. He had grown up basically as a sparring partner for Ali at Deer Lake, and he was undefeated as a heavyweight champion. And Ali has not fought for a year, I think, maybe a year and a half, and someone arranges this fight, and Ali is helpless in the fight. I saw Ali a year before that fight, and he weighed 260 pounds and had gray hair. For the fight, he weighed about 220 and had shining black hair, dyed. He was in no condition to fight. It was, I told somebody, it was like watching a friend die in a train wreck. That was the worst moment with me and Ali, to see him helpless against Holmes. Holmes wanted the fight stopped. Holmes kept begging the referee to stop the fight. Referee would not stop the fight. Finally, Herbert Muhammad, Elijah Muhammad's son, Ali's manager, stopped the fight. But then to see him later and to see him shaking, all the trembling, to see the Parkinson's mask of a face, I never went to another. I went to one more fight. Once it was clear, I've count myself and all of the boxing writers as accomplices. No one was going to stop Ali from fighting. He loved the attention. He loved the action. He wanted to fight. No one was going to stop him, but you didn't have to promote it. And I did. I was an accomplice in the destruction of Ali. Once it was clear that he was damaged, I never really bought the Parkinson's disease prognosis. I never bought into that. I just thought it was plain brain damage, the same brain damage that every punch-drunk fighter you've ever heard of suffered. Ali was hit in the head a million times. All this talk about CTE with chronic something, encephalitis, CTE with football players, all of that. Imagine those guys are suffering by playing football, wearing a helmet. How often do they get hit in the head? I don't know. Let's say 50 times a day. Ali got hit in the head a million times with no protection. It was brain damage that may have produced Parkinson's disease, but it was brain damage. He fought too long, got hit too many times. I've always said that the two best fighters of all time were Cassius Clay and Muhammad Ali. Cassius Clay, you could not hit. Then once he was suspended from boxing, came back, he was heavier, he was older, basically older, past his athletic prime. You could hit him, but you couldn't hurt him. But we saw the damage. We saw how badly he got hurt. So it was heart-wrenching. The last time I saw him at Berrien Springs, he wanted to show me his new boxing gym that was in a separate building on the grounds. We started to leave his office to walk maybe 50 feet to the gym, and he couldn't move his feet. Parkinson's patients have this problem where their feet get stuck and their body leans forward and they almost fall forward to get into motion. Ali couldn't get into motion. He couldn't move his feet. The most graceful, greatest athlete that I ever saw then grabbed my elbow and said, "Help." So I walked him over to the gym. And you can't get sadder than that. Can't get sadder than that as a human being to have seen what he was. I mean, literally a butterfly, almost literally a butterfly. And now he can't walk 50 feet to his gym without holding on to the elbow of a sports writer.
You've written a lot about ecstasy and agony. You've written an awful lot about golf. You love golf. Long time contributing editor to Golf Digest and the Masters, of course. Tell me about that Sunday when Greg Norman imploded.
Well, I was there, but Augusta, you know, the problem with all golf tournaments is that you can't be near the action. You have to watch it on TV. You know, so basically what I saw that day was it was predictable, really. It was predictable because Norman had shown tendencies to that. But Norman was not, in my mind, in any way, an attractive guy. You know, so I was certainly never had any emotional attachment to what happened with him. And, you know, he had an arrogance about him that rubbed me and a lot of people the wrong way. So it was not that you wanted to see him fail, but you knew that was possible. You knew it was possible that as soon as something went wrong, you know, he would be going the other direction. And that's what happened that day.
Was there one time, and maybe we've dealt with this in Ali, but was there one time when you had a hard time maintaining your objectivity?
Well, I never have thought objectivity was possible. You know, I think that you try to tell it fairly, you try to tell it honestly. And certainly as a columnist, you know, your job is almost to be subjective. You know, you're supposed to help shape opinions. You're supposed to take people to the event. And so I don't think objectivity, yeah, I just, my limitation on that, Keith, was I never wanted to be their friend. You know, I didn't want to be their friend. I was never Ali's friend. You know, as I said, I don't think he ever knew my name, but he knew I was there. And he knew, and it's certainly, you know, all hometown sports writers want the hometown team to win, because it's more fun to write about winning than it is to write about losing. And your readers certainly want to read more about winning than they want to read about losing. But nobody wins all the time. So you just have to try to be fair and honest. Don't be mean. You know, try to have fun. Try to make people smile is what I was always trying to do. I didn't care about being objective, because we all are the result of our life experience. And I don't think any of us can be cold, steel, objective. I think we all go to whatever happens in our life. Our life has prepared us for that moment, how we're going to react to it. So, but I think in terms of journalism, you know, you just have to be fair and honest as best you can.
What's the biggest mistake you ever made, and what did you learn from it?
Well, I don't think it's a mistake. But certainly a lot of people think it was a mistake. So maybe I'm completely wrong in my thinking. But when Richard Jewell was the central figure in the bombing that took place in the 1996 Olympics in Atlanta, he became, my newspaper at that time did a story saying that he was the focus of the FBI investigation. He certainly was. There was never a doubt about that. But the newspaper did not do it well. They wrote a voice of God, what we in the newspaper business call a voice of God report, in which there was no attribution as to who was saying Richard Jewell is the central subject of this manhunt. The FBI was saying it, but the newspaper did not report that was the FBI's thought. But it was clear when there was stakeout at Richard Jewell's apartment in Atlanta, Jewell became the suspect. I was a columnist. I was doing cityside column. I was doing whatever column I was doing during the Olympics. And of course, I went to the stakeout and I wrote a column after that. I sat there with the assembled news people, TV people from all around the country. FBI was searching Jewell's apartment. Jewell was sitting in a stairway in the shadows outside his apartment while the FBI was searching. I sat with, I remember, a videographer from Los Angeles who said that they're not finding anything. There's nothing. They're coming up empty. I quoted him in the column I wrote. I quoted some neighbors who were out there about what a good guy Richard was, what a good guy Richard is. He'll do anything for you. As I was leaving that scene, I came across a local photographer who said, this reminds me of the Wayne Williams scene. Wayne Williams was later convicted as a serial killer of children in Atlanta. I wrote a column in which I included that. And I said, and Wayne Williams is in prison now forever. And maybe my last line was, and Richard Jewell sits in the shadows. That column became subject of a lawsuit by Richard Jewell's people, that I had compared Richard Jewell, an uncharged, unarrested private citizen security guard, and I had compared him to the serial killer of children. If I had it to do over, I would do the column a different way, but not much different. Because all I did was present a scene as I saw it, and presented the scene of a guy's life hanging in the balance. What was going to happen to Richard Jewell? And the mere fact that I included a reference to Wayne Williams in that became a source of controversy for a long time. It was 15 years. A lot of news organizations were sued at that time by the Jewell people, including the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. The Atlanta Journal-Constitution was the only news organization that did not settle out of court. They fought the case. Eventually, the case was thrown out of court. My part in it was finally dismissed like 15 years later, where a judge said, you know, he's a columnist, has leeway, you know, and nothing in that column was presented as a fact connecting Richard Jewell to Wayne Williams.
Did you ever think about it at the time when you're, particularly when you're a sports columnist, that people are going to be injured by something I say? Or can you just, you have to just divorce yourself from that thought?
I think you have to divorce yourself from the thought. And I can give you one little anecdote as to why I say that. I went on a charter flight one time with Redskins fans to a Dallas Cowboys game in Dallas. There was a guy on the flight who I compared to Bluto. This was that tells you how long ago this was. Bluto was a character in the movie Animal House. He was a college guy, drunk all the time, you know. And so this guy on the Redskins charter was, I called him Bluto. I reported what he did. I didn't use his name. I called him Bluto. He was just drunk, you know, badgering people, harassing people, just trying to have fun, I guess, but it was just annoying. I called him Bluto. 6 months later, a year later, I got a letter. This guy says, you don't know my name, but I'm Bluto. And I want to thank you for what you wrote about me. You know, this is his name. And then tried to find his name because I knew he wasn't going to like what I wrote about him. But he thanked me for it. So I'm thinking, oh, well, good. That's good. And he thanked me for it because he said, it's the first time I recognized who I was. And I want you to know that I've been through rehab now. I regret everything that I've ever been, and I've changed my life. So that's one of the ways that you don't know. I think you can't predict the consequences of what you write. I would have thought that this guy would want to, you know, cause me trouble or something. Instead, he thanked me. for pointing out who he was. So, and I was deposed as part of the Richard Jewell case because I quoted his mother. I quoted his mother. I quoted Richard Jewell's mother in this thing. And I was deposed maybe 2 years later by an attorney named Lynn Wood. Lynn Wood at that time was Richard Jewell's lawyer. Lynn Wood deposed me and at one point asked your question. Did you ever think how this would affect Richard's mother? And my entire answer to that question was no. I never once, when I was writing, thought about what his mother would think of the column. So I guess that's probably the answer all the time. I mean, you don't want to take cheap shots, but if something needs to be said, you say it. You don't take gratuitous shots at somebody's character or somebody's looks or whatever, just for the fun of it. But if something needs to be said that you know will have an impact on their life, you say it. You let the chips fall where they may. You just try to be fair and honest about it.
If you're determined to give an honest opinion, if you temper it at all, it's not honest.
Yeah. I think that's a good way to put it. You know, and you know, if you, and a lot of guys have done that. I mean, I've read a lot of columns like that where they apologize in advance for what I'm going to say. You know, just say it, you know. But that's one reason I've never wanted to be their friends. I've never wanted to be a sports writer so that I could be the coach's friend or the star's friend. I never wanted that, not in any way. You know, I taught at Illinois Wesleyan and at Bradley, you know, sports journalism classes. And, you know, the kids show up wearing a Cubs jacket or wearing a Blackhawks sweater or something. And I say, I'm here to defan you. I don't want you to be a fan of these teams. You know, I want you to be a fan of reporting and a fan of writing. If you want to be in the business just so you can be in the clubhouse with your Cubs heroes, you're here for all the wrong reasons. So I didn't want to be anybody's friend because at some point you're going to have to write about that friend, you know, being arrested or being fired or something. So you want to try as best you can, largely impossible, of course, you know, to be, not objective, but just be fair and honest. And if somebody is really your friend, you know, you're going to shade the truth somehow. And I didn't want to ever be accused of that.
When you and Cheryl retired, you moved back to Illinois and you started following a local high school girls basketball team. Tell me the rest of the story.
Well, that was 11 years ago, going on 12 years ago. You know, I had a friend's daughter was on the high school team. I went to a game, discovered that I could not go to a game without wanting to write about what I saw. So I went to a father of one of the players who was running a website dedicated to the girls and asked him if I could write for him. He later was quoted as saying, this disheveled old guy came out of the stands and wanted to write for me. Well, he was right about half of that. I don't think I was that disheveled, but I started writing. That's been 11 years ago. I've written probably 400,000 words now about that high school team. I've written 4 books. They turned out to be a good team. It won 4 state championships in their class, 3A out of 4. At one point in 4 years, their record was 201-14. So I called them in print the Golden State Warriors, only with ponytails. You know, it's been fun. It's been, and I've written about them as I don't do X's and O's. I don't do play by play. I find something to write about every night because, you know, and they were very good. They'd win games by 30 and 40 and 50 points all the time, you know, so there's never a point, never really a point of talking about the way they played. But I found something to write about every night. But there's another one of my theories on journalism, I guess, maybe certainly sports journalism. If you're paying attention, you'll see something every night that you've never seen before. Write about that. And I've done that for over 350 games. I've tried to, every game, it's just, I'll find something that I've never seen before and I'll write about it. I first had that thought when I worked for the National and followed Michael Jordan around for a week, and he would do something every night I'd never seen before. So I started looking for that every game, whether basketball, football, whatever. And so there's always, mostly these 400,000 words on this girls' basketball team have been, you know, 300 little essays about whatever, maybe how Cheryl and I got lost on the way to Dunlap. And why do the city fathers of Dunlap keep moving that city around every year? I can't find it. You know, things like that. You know, one night, Star twisted her ankle. Her father came out of the stands and carried her to the training room. Well, I'd never seen that before, so I wrote about that. And, you know, it's very easy if you're paying attention and you've been paying attention for a long time to find stuff that's worth writing about. And I've never once thought that I've written anything about this girls' basketball team. I've never written anything less professionally than anything I ever wrote about Ali. You know, it's not like it's beneath me. I think it's just a test of another way to write. And I've loved it.
And what do you get out of that, Dave? What does that do for you?
Well, the physical manifestation of what it does for me is a box of Milk Duds every game.
Well, I wasn't talking about compensation.
Said, look,
but
I'm a professional sport. Yeah, I know. Yeah, so there's that. But there's also, you know, we moved back here. I'm 70 years old when we moved back here. You know, my wife had a small stroke. She had a huge stroke 5 years later. She spent 5.5 years in a nursing home, invalid who couldn't communicate until she died 8 months ago. So it was a community for me. It was a thing to do. It was people who cared about me. It was life affirming to see all these kids, you know, 15, 16, 17 years old with their entire life ahead of them, having the best time of their life. I mean, if you don't have a good time in high school, when are you ever going to have a good time? And these were athletes. I felt almost a little obligation also, because I spent 50 years in big time sports writing and almost never wrote about women in sports. You know, Title IX happened in 1972. You know, so in year 2010, I start writing about women in athletics and wrote about them ever since. Felt I owed a little bit to that, but mostly it was life affirming. It was, otherwise I'd be sitting in this house by myself, you know, nothing to do, you know, and I like to write. I like to report and I like to write. So it is who I am. It is who I will be, you know, and until I can't do it. You know, I'm 80 years old. You know, I don't know how long I can do it. I don't want to, you know, I want to do it until I can't or until it makes no sense to do it. I mean, I've driven through snowstorms to go to games 50 miles away where they're going to win by 50 points, you know, but it's been fun. All of it's been fun and met a lot of great people, a lot of, A lot of the girls that were girls are now mothers. You know, I still know them. It created a sense of community that really, as a big time sports writer, I never had. Because again, I'm not a big time guy. You know, I didn't want to be in Washington, D.C., going to all the fancy places with all the fancy people. You know, I'm an Atlanta, Illinois guy, and I now live back in Atlanta, Illinois, and I'm very happy to do that.
Thanks to Lane McGivney and all the good folks at Boutwell Studios for all the TLC required to bring this podcast to life, and audio engineers Joe Beeman and Jonathan W. Hickman. Remember, everyone has a special talent. You just need to identify it, cultivate it, and be willing to pay the price. You too can become an American Achiever.